Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the workshop, you will hear from our panel of expert speakers. We will allow time for questions and comments following the presentation. Instructions will be given at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you so much, Crystal, and I too would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect Education Workshop. Today's program is focusing on update on chronic lymphocytic leukemia, or CLL. And today's program is done in collaboration with the CLL Society, which is a wonderful resource for all of you on the call today. We also collaborate with many other cancer organizations, and it really is because of that collaboration. And I also want to thank the CLL Society particularly for sending out lots of emails to tell all of everyone about the program as well, that we have over 555 participants on the call today, and you come from all over the United States, and we also have international participants from Algeria, Canada, France, Germany, Greece, Hong Kong, India, Italy, Japan, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, and United Kingdom. So you really come from all over the world, and it really is a credit to all of you that you've chosen to spend this next hour with us. Today's program is supported by an educational grant from Pharmacyclics LLC, an AbbVie company, Janssen Biotech, Inc., administered by Janssen Scientific Affairs, LLC, Gilead, and Novartis Oncology. And I really want to thank them for their support of the program, but also for their corporate collaboration and partnership in making this program possible. Now, we have wonderful speakers on our program today, and I want to begin by introducing our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. John Pagel. Dr. Pagel is Chief of Hematologic Malignancies Program, Director of Stem Cell Transplantation, Swedish Cancer Institute, Seattle, Washington. And Dr. Pagel is going to address an overview of chronic lymphocytic leukemia, or CLL, current treatment options, and clinical trial updates. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Pagel.
Great. Nice to be with everybody. I will just start by saying I'm here in Seattle, Washington. I'm looking out my window, and actually we have a break in the rain. We have had, between February and March, the two rainiest months ever on record. So come visit us in the summer and the fall, but not right now. Well, listen, I'm going to spend a few minutes, actually maybe 10, 15 minutes, talking about an overview of CLL and touch base on the current treatments and clinical trial updates. But I also want to be clear that I think Dr. Brown, who's truly an international leader in these fields, will also add to those topics, and I look forward to hearing that as well. Let me just give a brief overview of CLL and what it looks like. It's not uncommon. This is the most common leukemia in adults. There's about 19 or 20,000 cases diagnosed per year in the United States. Not a large number. We do recognize that, but what is large is what we call the prevalence. There's about 150,000 people who are living with the disease, and that's because this, as it says, is a chronic disease. Many people will be living with this disease for many years, perhaps even many decades. We have seen that the survival continues to improve, and it continues to improve because of some of the things we're going to talk about here today. Those are many of the new novel treatment options and many of those that are continuing to come down the pike or down the road that will be options for many patients as we move forward to continue towards our ultimate goal, which is, of course, to cure this disease. This is typically a disease of people who are a little bit older. The median age at the time of diagnosis is around 72 years of age. Median meaning about half of patients are below the age of 72 and half of patients are above the age of 72. And as I said, survival has continued to increase and people do very well, despite the fact that they might need some treatment every once in a while, and we'll talk more about that. Let me just say that in general, there aren't known particular risk factors for CLL for developing the disease. Most people, of course, who are interested in this call either have CLL or they have a loved one or family member who do. We do know that men have a higher incidence than women, perhaps twice as much. We do know that it's more common in Caucasians in the United States. We don't really understand why. We do think there's some genetic or environmental exposures that may play a role as well, but that's not well elucidated. And we know that there is a familial component in a very small number of cases, maybe only about 5% of cases, where patients may have a first-degree relative who has CLL. What is CLL? CLL is what we call a B-cell lymphoma or leukemia. It is, as I say, a B-cell, meaning that is a type of white blood cell called a lymphocyte. There are two types of lymphocytes, either called B-cells or T-cells. And as you know, you can have a cancer anywhere in your body. You can have also cancer of blood cells. Blood just happens to be in a liquid form as opposed to a solid tumor that you might have in a breast or a colon or a prostate. And cancer is simply that something has gone wrong in these cells. They behave abnormally. And there are two major problems that happen in a CLL cell. One is that they make too many of themselves. They're becoming clones of themselves. Perhaps you know the Star Wars white stormtroopers. They all look exactly alike. Those are all clones of themselves, and that's what's happening here. These cells are not going on and maturing and becoming cells with a normal function. They become abnormal and make more of themselves. And the other problem is that those cells don't die. And that's why people can get big lymph nodes over a long period of time. It might be why their spleen gets big over a long period of time. And even the bone marrow can become involved, and bone marrow is just like a big lymph node, as is the spleen. And because this is a disease we call leukemia, it's a disease that circulates in the blood. That's the definition of leukemia. So it's chronic. People live with it for a long time. Lymphocytic, because it's developing in a lymphoid cell, a lymphocyte, and leukemia, meaning circulating in the blood. And many patients actually will ask the question, well, what caused this? How did I get this? Well, we don't really typically have a good answer. In fact, we have very few answers, and sometimes you have to say it's unfortunately perhaps just bad luck that something went wrong in one of these maturing B cells, and it wasn't repaired, and it led to, again, a clonal proliferation of cells and a disease called chronic lymphocytic leukemia. We do know that it's been associated with Agent Orange, but otherwise we don't know clear exposures in the environment or radiation exposures as an example that would be a cause of CLL. I did mention familial CLL, and I'll come back to it just real quick to say that it doesn't happen often. At about 5% of the time will people have a first-degree relative, but we don't screen for it in families, even if there is a family member who has CLL. And the reason is that we don't think it behaves differently, whether it's a familial component or if it's not associated with a family member. And in fact, we really wouldn't have anything that we would do if we were screening for it or found it. So we don't typically do that. So somebody commonly will typically go to their doctor. They will have a routine blood test, and they will find out that their white blood cell count might be a little bit elevated. And if you look a little closer, it's the lymphocyte count that's a little bit elevated. We have a series of sophisticated tests called flow cytometry tests, where we actually look at the what we call markers on the surface of these cells that are characteristic for CLL, and we make a diagnosis usually very easily just looking at a blood test. Most people who present are completely asymptomatic, in fact, the majority of patients. And what we do for those people is we tell them, listen, you do have this, you're going to do fine probably for long periods of time, and we're not going to do anything right now. In fact, what we tell people is you have to have a good reason to get treated, even in 2017 with all the great drugs that we have. You need a good reason to be treated. They're well-defined criteria, in fact, for what those good reasons are. But without those, we just watch. And many times people will be watched for years and years. In fact, rare cases, but maybe even decades without any intervention. Eventually, people do have some indication for treatment, and they get some treatment. Their disease gets knocked down. It may stay down for years and years, but it typically will come back. And that may go off and on for, again, a long period of time. What are those indications for treatment? Well, there's a variety of them, and you could imagine they could be a lot of symptoms. You're losing weight, you're not feeling well, you're having drenching night sweats. Could be a rapidly growing spleen or lymph nodes or a rapidly doubling white blood cell count. And when we see all those things, that's when, of course, we start thinking about different treatments or approaching a patient to begin treatment. And the good news is that there's lots of new and exciting treatments. I will just say selfishly for investigators like Dr. Brown and myself, this is a fascinating, exciting time to be involved in the research, and that translates to great things for patients. And there's lots of treatment options for patients. We have, of course, chemotherapy regimens, or what we like to call chemoimmunotherapy regimens, because we typically combine chemotherapy with a biologic treatment known as an antibody treatment. I suspect most people on the call have heard of antibodies such as rituximab, or now newer improved antibodies, a new generation called obinutuzumab, which has gotten a lot of attention more recently. And there's a lot of other biologic antibodies that are coming down the pike for treatment for patients with CLL. The chemotherapy regimens have been around for a long time, and a lot of people will ask, well, geez, with our approaches in 2017, aren't we getting away from chemotherapy? And many patients, that is true, and the reason it might be true is that if you're an older patient in particular, you may not be able to tolerate chemotherapy particularly well, and you might think of some other type of less aggressive treatment or better tolerated therapy. Before I talk about what those might look like, I think it's important to understand that there's still a major role for chemotherapy in many patients today who have CLL. In particular, they may be patients who are a bit younger. I like to think younger is in the 50s or 60s, of course, because I'm in those areas. But we do know that people who get chemoimmunotherapy, like regimens such as FCR, fludarabine cytoxan and rituxan, or even regimens like BR, bendamustine and rituximab, those are the two most common chemoimmunotherapy regimens, that people can do extremely well, they can have long durations of remission, and tolerate the regimens very well. FCR, in fact, in a very favorable patient population who might be a little bit younger, who can tolerate it, has been shown to give remissions well over a decade in about 30 or so percent of patients. So there is always a role and important discussion that patients should have with their doctor about if chemotherapy is still an option for them or an appropriate option at some point in their care. But it is true that we have evolved away from that a little bit. More recently, we've been exploring and really shifting the paradigm of how we treat patients with CLL by using what we call targeted treatments. These are agents that are typically delivered in pill form. They're small molecules that are designed to attack a certain protein or enzyme inside of a B lymphocyte, and in particular, a CLL cell. And I suspect everybody here has gotten some wind of ibrutinib, idelalisib, the two approved drugs, as well as a more recent approved drug in higher-risk patients with 17p deletions called venetoclax. These are all important drugs that have changed the paradigm, as I've said, about how we approach patients. We do know that many people will see all of these drugs at one time or another through sequencing as we move through their treatment encounters, and they're all appropriate at different times, and that's a very important discussion to continue to have with your physician and your treating team. I will just say the one area where we know that chemotherapy is typically not particularly helpful is those people with the highest risk disease who have a deletion of the short arm of chromosome 17. If you're not familiar with it, you'll hear a discussion commonly as a 17p deletion. And those people don't do quite as well with chemotherapy, and thus we think about regimens like ibrutinib or venetoclax or idelalisib for them. I think Dr. Brown will probably talk a lot more about those agents and in particular their side effects. And sometimes the side effects are help us figure out which drug we're going to use at which time. Before I wrap up, I just do want to say a minute about clinical trial options that I hope everybody who is undergoing treatment at one time or another for their CLL will consider. Clinical trials are important, especially in oncology, because it provides an opportunity for patients to get something new and novel that has tremendous promise to be an improvement over the standard of care. development of new drugs are largely why I started this by saying we've extended survivals in patients who have CLL. People are living longer and longer. And actually, we do believe that many people will not die of a complication of their CLL. So that's a good thing. And the only way that we are able to achieve that is through participation in clinical trials. Always ask your doctor if there's a clinical trial that might be right for you and explore the option. It's a safe option. Really, we don't do clinical trials in oncology or in CLL if it doesn't make sense, if it has to be something that we think has a high likelihood of helping a patient. And that even happens in early phase clinical trials. I would encourage people not to be put off or swayed by an early phase trial with a novel drug. Many times those are very important and can be highly helpful for controlling disease. There are many important drugs in development in clinical trials right now. They come into big categories, but in general what they are new improved versions of drugs that we have to this point, second generation or new improved versions of ibrutinib, or new and improved versions of a drug known as idelalisib, which is a different agent. These new drugs continue to advance the field, and I think that we could talk more about those, and I'm going to maybe at this point give that an opportunity to let Dr. Brown jump in and give us some of her insight.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Pagel. That was outstanding. Wonderful overview and just really lots of excellent information. And I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. The questions are actually coming in already online, and we haven't even given instructions yet, so this is amazing. Our next speaker is Dr. Jennifer Brown. Dr. Brown is Director, Chronic Lymphocytic Leukemia Center, Senior Physician, Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, Associate Professor of Medicine, Harvard Medical School, Boston, Massachusetts. And Dr. Brown is going to address new and emerging treatment updates, tips to manage side effects, and communicating with the healthcare team about quality of life concerns. It's my pleasure now to turn this panel over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Brown.
Thank you very much, and I'm very happy to be on the call today. I'm in Boston, where it's raining very heavily. We're having a little bit of more ongoing winter, I would say. And I think Dr. Pagel really did a great job introducing CLL as well as our new and emerging treatments and clinical trials. Because really, the last few years have just seen an explosion of exciting new drugs in CLL, and four or five are now FDA approved and available for people. And because they're still new, there's still trials going on with them. We're still trying to learn more about them. And as you heard from Dr. Pagel, drugs like ibrutinib and idelalisib and venetoclax differ from traditional chemotherapy in the sense that they're more targeted specifically against the CLL cells. Now, that doesn't mean that they don't have side effects. They do have side effects, which we're going to talk about in detail. But those side effects are a little bit more specific to each drug in its own way, rather than some of the general side effects that we tend to see with chemotherapy. And so now that we have these drugs available, I think what we're looking to do with ongoing clinical trials and as we move forward is to understand better which drug is best for each patient and what we can expect from each drug in a given patient, as well as to potentially start to combine them so that we can get even deeper remissions and even better results than we're already getting, although the results we're already getting are really quite phenomenal with all these drugs. And we've already learned enough about ibrutinib and idelalisib, for example, as Dr. Pagel mentioned, that work is going into trying to improve upon them with the so-called next generation of drugs. And these would be drugs that are targeted against the same target. So ibrutinib hits a protein called BTK. That's something that's really important to the survival of the CLL, and blocking it is very good for inhibiting and killing the CLL. And so we can generate other drugs against that same target that may, for example, have fewer side effects than some of what we're seeing with ibrutinib. and there's a lot of effort going into that. There's also some new effort. We do sometimes see resistance to ibrutinib start to come out, and we'd like to be able to address that too. It turns out that there does seem to be one most common way in which that happens, in which the CLL kind of finds its way around the ibrutinib. And so now there are drugs coming out that are designed to prevent that way that the CLL gets around the ibrutinib and or to treat it with a drug that's still against the same target as ibrutinib, but that hits it in a different way. So that's all really exciting in terms of how we'll use ibrutinib and other drugs that hit the same target going forward. And with alpelisib, similarly, we're getting a better understanding of the side effect profile, and there are next generation drugs that hit the same target as alpelisib that have slightly different profiles, and where we hope that may reduce the side effects but maintain or even improve the effectiveness. Another drug which Dr. Pagel mentioned, which I think is very exciting and still emerging because it's really only has a very limited approval right now, and is venetoclax. And that's also an oral drug. And it's a little bit different than the ibrutinib and the alpelisib in the sense that ibrutinib and alpelisib show a very interesting pattern when we start patients on them. A lot of times the white count may go up before it goes down. And that's because the CLL cells are all pulled out of the bone marrow and blood into the lymph nodes, the bone marrow and lymph nodes into the blood. And so they turn up in the blood. But then that's a good thing because they die more easily in the blood, either spontaneously or, for example, give another drug along with it. Venetoclax actually kills the cells very directly in the blood and bone marrow. And so the white count will go down initially. And so that's a little bit different and suggests that combinations of these drugs going forward may be very interesting. And so I think there's a lot of excitement in the field about putting together these targeted inhibitors to get the best results and move, as we hope, toward cure for this disease. So let's talk a little bit about the specific side effects of some of the drugs, or really of treatment in general, and then perhaps about these specific drugs. So most treatments, as you know, chemotherapy treatments, as well as these oral treatments, can cause some level of fatigue. CLL itself, of course, also causes fatigue. And the amount of fatigue caused by the treatment varies from person to person. And in general, we think it may be more sometimes with the chemotherapy than with the oral drugs, but it's variable. And so, you know, it's important to take good general care of yourself, get plenty of rest, try to get plenty of sleep. I also encourage people to remain active as they're able to keep their energy levels up in that way, so that then over time the effects will hopefully be lessened of the therapy. All of our treatments also can have some GI side effects. This could include some nausea, which we have very, very good medications for. And if you do have nausea, you should absolutely take the medications to help with it because they can be really transforming in terms of managing that. There's also constipation or diarrhea, depending on the type of therapy. And constipation, typical over-the-counter stool softeners, et cetera, can help manage that. Diarrhea. We also have medications to control that. Depending on the type of drug that you may be on and how much diarrhea there is, that's something that may be managed differently by your physician. And so, and as with all of these symptoms, you always do want to tell your care team, and that can be your physician, but that can also be your nurse or your mid-level practitioner, your nurse practitioner or physician assistant. Many times people feel more comfortable going to those people or that they're more available. And you should always reach out to your team with anything that you're experiencing because they may have good hints or it may be something that we need to know about to try and help you feel better with the treatment you're on. Or maybe we even need to change the treatment. And that's okay. There are a lot of different treatment options for CLL. So if one isn't quite agreeing with you, there is bound to be another one which will work well. Another thing that comes up fairly often with CLL is that there is some infection risk just with CLL itself, as I think people know. And then even the various treatments can sometimes potentially increase that risk some. And so we always want people to be careful if they're having, if they start to feel feverish, to check their temperature and to let the team, physician and care team, know if you do develop a fever, because that's something that we need to know about and that we may need to evaluate. And for many treatments, you may also be given some medications to prevent certain types of infections that we know can come up during treatment. And I strongly encourage you, if that's recommended, to do that, because that does really help avoid problems that, you know, we don't need to have, because the preventative medicines do help. Now let's talk a few minutes about the specific side effects of some of the oral drugs. So ibrutinib, we talked about GI side effects, and it is pretty common to get some mild diarrhea with ibrutinib. It usually starts early on, first couple of months, and in many people it seems to resolve after the early phase. And we can just manage that symptomatically with over-the-counter drugs like Imodium, for example. Some people will also get some nausea. And again, there are anti-nausea pills. And I have actually found that if people take their drugs at night, that that often helps reduce some of the GI side effects. So that's something I often recommend for people. Joint aches are also not uncommon with ibrutinib, probably a little more common soon after starting than later. And there's not, they tend to be self-limited, like they'll happen and they tend to get better. Sometimes they'll move around. And anti-inflammatory drugs, in particular Tylenol, can be good for that. If necessary, if it's really bad, sometimes we'll do a short course of steroid treatment because that can help relieve that. Leg swelling is also pretty common with ibrutinib, and it's good to keep one's legs up, to exercise, to wear compression stockings to try and help with that. A couple of the more serious side effects of the ibrutinib that we worry about, one of them is bruising or bleeding. And so that's something that you just have to be aware of and try to avoid taking other things that may encourage it. So we generally encourage people, if it's possible, to not be on blood thinners at the same time, although sometimes we will combine those depending on a given person's exact situation. We generally recommend not taking fish oil or vitamin E because those can enhance some of the bruisability that we see. And then if you are having a procedure, we hold the drug. We hold the ibrutinib for 3 to 7 days before and after the procedure, and that's really very helpful to let healing occur and not result in bleeding. Another one of the more serious side effects is a heart rhythm problem called atrial fibrillation. And this is it's manageable, and many people who have it stay on ibrutinib without a problem. But it might be a little bit scary if it happens, because you might feel your heart beating fast and might end up needing to go to the emergency room, although many people with it are fine and don't need to go to the emergency room. And that's just a matter of, we get you on medications to control the rhythm and potentially on blood thinners and manage it. Now, alpelisib has a separate set of side effects, and these can include elevated liver tests, which, again, is something you mostly require monitoring. They don't typically cause symptoms for people, which is good. And they tend to happen in about the second month on therapy. Things that need to be watched out for with alpelisib are that sometimes you can get a drug-related pneumonia, which can happen a little bit later, after 3 or 4 months. And so if you start having a cough or shortness of breath, again, this is something to have a low threshold to bring to attention of your team. Rashes are also not uncommon, actually, with alpelisib or ibrutinib, and we tend to manage those, again, symptomatically, so with topical treatments like steroids, for example. And with alpelisib, there can also be a more serious diarrhea, which can happen at any time on the drug, but even after a long time, months or years. And so if, again, that's a situation where you may think you've been on a drug for years, but that doesn't mean it can't be related to the drug. And so, again, that needs to be brought rapidly to the attention of your team. And venetoclax, actually, I was mentioning earlier that it clears the cells from the blood really quickly. Its main side effect is actually related to clearing the cells so rapidly from the blood, that those cells release substances into the blood that can be bad for the kidneys and the heart and potentially dangerous. And so when the drug is started, we start with a low dose and we slowly increase it, and there's close monitoring of labs that's done each time that the dose is started or increased. And that doesn't typically result in symptoms for people, but it's just sort of the monitoring that needs to be done. And usually we encourage people to drink plenty of fluids during that time. And that's in general a good idea when any treatment is started, to drink plenty of fluids to help the body get rid of the dying tumor cell products. And otherwise, venetoclax can also cause some GI, again, some nausea, loss of appetite, or diarrhea. And it usually isn't too severe. Sometimes taking the drug at night is better, again, supportive measures. And all of this sort of underscores why you don't want to suffer in silence with any of this. And, you know, we want to hear about it. Your physicians want to hear about it because we want to make sure that you're feeling well on your treatment and that we're doing everything we can to manage it. And if for some reason there's an aspect that we can't manage as well as we would like, then we want to know about it and see if we can potentially change the treatment so it works better for you. So don't hesitate to bring any of these concerns to the attention of your team, and, you know, keep bringing it up if it's not getting better. We really do want to know and want to work with you on this and try and help you with it. So I think I'll perhaps stop there so we have time for questions.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Brown. That was outstanding and really covering a great many areas in terms of both the emerging treatments and also the management of side effects. So thank you so much. And I know that there are questions for you during the Q&A, so thank you. And our next speaker is Dr. Brian Kaufman. And Dr. Kaufman is founder and medical director of CLL Society and has been a really important force in his organization in founding the organization, but also in helping to promote today's program and keeping you all aware of what this program is about. So I want to bring Dr. Kaufman on, my esteemed colleague, and he will address CLL Society's free programs and services. Dr. Kaufman.
First, I want to thank everyone for listening and thank Cancer Care for this opportunity and say, you know, wow, it's like I'm so lucky to be on this call with my friends Dr. Brown and Dr. Pagel. You know, not all of us, however, are lucky enough to have access to such experts. And that's where the CLL Society and other helpful organizations, other helpful nonprofits try to fill the gap. You know, I'm a family doctor turned CLL patient, and I founded the CLL Society to ensure that all patients got their best possible care. And as we learned today, CLL has some rapidly changing and improving treatments. So we push hard to make sure that patients are all getting expert advice and becoming very knowledgeable about our disease. You know, our motto is that smart patients get smart care. And to help that, besides working with Cancer Care and others in educational programs, we provide several services. All of these are free, and all of them are CLL-specific. Our website, which is thecllsociety.org, is full of patient-friendly information from the very basics to data on new clinical trials to the latest research, news, conference coverage. We have links to other helpful sites. We have an online toolkit that has downloadable files, including how to build your CLL team, a CLL glossary, abbreviations and acronyms, links to CLL experts around the world, including the two that are on the phone with us right now, normal lab values, a spreadsheet to help track your lab results. And we know that not everyone gets all their information online, so we have several live support and educational groups that meet monthly across the country. You can check CLLsociety.org for the details. We sponsor live CLL specific educational forums with experts like we've heard today. And we do research to provide hard data to the doctors about what patients want in their care. So let us know how we can help. You know, visit our website, CLLsociety.org, sign up for our alerts. It'll bring you the latest CLL news and interviews. And you can also get my personal 12 commandments for living well with CLL. Remember that smart patients get smart care. And My motto is stay strong. We're all in this together, and smart patients get smart care. Thanks.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Kaufman. That was wonderful and just really such a wonderful call out to your organization and the resources that you have there for everyone. And before we take questions, I do want to say just a few words about Cancer Care. Cancer Care is a national organization, and we provide free psychosocial support and counseling to people living with cancer, as well as practical and financial assistance. So what that translates to is that you can simply call our 800 number, and you can speak with one of our oncology social workers about any concern you may have, from practical to financial issues, to wanting to talk with someone about your concerns, to joining a support group for people with CLL, or joining a support group on the telephone or online, and also just visiting our website and just getting more information. So these services are available to you, and of course the CL Society as well, and there are many others. We want you to be sure, and of course your healthcare team, of course, but we want you to be aware of these organizations as resources. And now we have time for questions, and I'm going to ask Crystal to explain to all of you how to queue up for questions. We're going to bring all of our speakers on board, and we're going to try to take as many of your questions as possible. And if we don't get your questions at the end of the call, I'll give you information about how to get your questions answered. Okay, Crystal?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star, then 1 on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Those of you on the web may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question. And our first question comes from Allison S. Your line is open.
Hi. Do you do DNA testing on this particular cancer like they do on others to identify it more specifically?
Could you repeat the question just one more time, please?
Sure. Do they do DNA testing on this type of cancer?
Thank you for that question.
So they identify it.
Yes. Oh, go ahead. Yes. Sorry.
I'm not sure
who's
did you
thinking,
understand
wanna,
the
question? Did you want to
do DNA testing on this type of cancer?
Okay.
Right.
Excellent. We can hear you now. Excellent question. And I'm going to ask Dr. Pagel if you could address that question to start.
Right. I think Dr. Brown probably could have some input as well.
Okay.
You know, it's still a research tool at this point. It is done. It's commonly done either as part of a clinical trial, or it can be done in specific settings where the information hopefully would be helpful. It is, however, still in, I think, a process in development. We do know that there are specific changes, or what we call mutations, that can happen in the genetic material. But we don't know exactly how to act on those mutations at this point or what they mean. We hopefully will in the future. That's why we are doing research and more investigation. I would say that that might be something that you also want to talk to about with your doctor, if that would be a reasonable approach for a specific patient in particular, if it would have impact in your care. I also would say that Dr. Brown's institution, the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, have been international world leaders in this area, so maybe Jen has a comment as well.
Thank you.
You know, I would agree completely that specific tests for specific mutations are still a research tool, that because we don't know how or whether we should change treatment based on them. I would maybe generalize the question just a bit to point out that the one type of testing, which is broadly speaking still involving DNA, that we do is chromosome testing, or the so-called FISH test. And that's because we really want to check, as Dr. Pagel talked about in his presentation, for loss of the short arm of chromosome 17 or 17P, because that one we do actually change our treatment. And so that is, in the broad sense of genetic testing, a form of it. And that one is actually important that we do at a time of treatment, at least.
Excellent. Thank you. And our next question, actually for Dr. Brown. The question is from one of our online participants. Is it normal to have pain, fatigue with CLL, SLL? I have been in watch and wait since June 2016 with only moderate increase in lymphocyte counts. And could you comment also on that CLL, SLL part of the question as well?
Okay. So the CLL, SLL question, this is often very confusing for people that sometimes it's called a leukemia, CLL, chronic lymphocytic leukemia, and other times it might be called a lymphoma, small lymphocytic lymphoma. And what I always like to tell people is that the cells are all the same, and the word leukemia just refers to if the cells are in the blood, lymphoma just refers to cells in the lymph node. But with CLL, SLL, which is sort of what we call it now, we put it all together because the cells in the disease are the same, and they're basically everywhere, potentially in the blood, lymph node, or bone marrow. And so regardless of where it is, we more or less consider it the same disease, the CLL, SLL. And it arises, and yeah, so that's what I would say about that. Now, so the question of symptoms for people with early stage disease is a thorny one, because certainly many people do feel more fatigued. Many patients tell me they feel sort of warmer, that they sweat more easily. Pain, you know, I don't know exactly the nature of the pain, but I would say that some people have pain in lymph nodes when they initially expand, and they can go up and down. When they expand, sometimes that's painful, and usually will respond to anti-inflammatories and then usually will abate. Sometimes the spleen, which if that's enlarging, can also cause some pain. But it's important just to make sure that your doctor's aware of any pain to make sure there isn't something else going on. And similarly with fatigue, I have often found other causes of fatigue in some of my early stage CLL patients, although there are definitely patients with early stage CLL who do have significantly more fatigue than before. And it becomes a question whether that is sufficient to initiate treatment, because many of the treatments also cause fatigue. And so I often have long discussions with my patients about this, that unless the fatigue is very severe, the treatment may not necessarily improve it. And so sort of finding other ways to manage it, as long as you're able to carry on with your usual life activities, sometimes is better initially. John, did you want to add anything?
No, I think it's all well said. I guess the one thing I would say is that fatigue is very common in particular, and if it's very significant, sometimes that is a reason to get some treatment, actually, if it's very significant. I've had many times, I bet Dr. Brown is as well, where people don't have glaring problems with lymph nodes or their white count, but they're so profoundly fatigued that when they get treated, they actually feel significantly better. Lots of times I've even had people tell me, hey, I didn't really realize that I wasn't feeling so good because I feel so much better now. So treatment can be really helpful in that regard.
Thank you. And how much question?
True.
Oh, yes. Thank you. Thank you both. So we have a question now for Dr. Pagel. The question is, I see that you are a director of stem cell transplantation at your hospital. Are stem cell transplants still a viable treatment option for CLL, SLL?
So it's a really great question. I guess before I give much of an answer, I'll just say it's a timely question as well, because if you go to Dr. Kaufman's website, he can give another plug for it better than I can, and I hope he will. CLL Society, I wrote a little newsletter article for them on this exact topic just for the month of March, or I guess it might even be month of April. So it's very timely. I would go look at that if you want a more in-depth answer to this question. But I'll just touch on it here. It's a complicated subject, as you could imagine. In general, we don't do lots of transplants for patients with CLL, and there are lots of reasons for that. I think the biggest reason is that we have lots of other drugs that tend to extend life and people do very well and avoid the risk of having a major complication that's commonly associated with a transplant. transplants actually are important in the right patient, but most patients will never need a transplant. They will do fine managing through agents like ibrutinib or venetoclax or idelalisib or even chemotherapy and never have to have that risk of having a major life-threatening complication that might be associated with a transplant. There are patients who can benefit from a transplant that we know need a transplant. It's fortunately, again, very rare or less common, I should say. But we do it when we need to in the right patients. So who are those patients? Well, they're typically people who might be a little bit younger. And commonly, they're people who actually really need it. They've exhausted all their options. They've really run out of different appropriate treatments, and really we need to actually do something very different. And the type of transplant we're talking about is what we call an allogeneic transplant. That type of transplant uses someone else as a donor to provide stem cells and allow the patient or the recipient to get a new immune system from the donor. And it's that donor's immune system that typically eradicates the disease. Where the risk is through the problems of suppressing the patient's immune system to allow those donor cells to take hold, and the risk for potential significant infections, or even another problem we call graft versus host disease. And because of those things, typically the risks aren't warranted to undergo a stem cell transplant. But when we do, the goal is to cure the patient, to keep the disease from coming back. And an allogeneic transplant is what we kind of think of as the ultimate immunotherapy or immune-based treatment, in that we do know that there are people who can get an allogeneic transplant and never have their disease come back. But again, I want to stress it's with significant risk. And I'll just say also, as part of the answer to the question that wasn't addressed in the question, is we have lots of other treatments, and in particular now we have something called CAR T cell therapy, or chimeric antigen receptor T cell therapy, that I'd encourage you to look into as well as another option that delays or even puts off a need for an allogeneic transplant.
Excellent, thank you. And Dr. Kaufman, did you want to comment on the information on your website about this as well?
Yeah, Dr. Pagel wrote a nice patient-friendly review on the kind of latest place for hemopoietic stem cell transplants. You'll find it in our last newsletter. So if you just go to the news section, pull up the NAST newsletter, you'll find that article by Dr. Pagel where he talks about transplants for CLL and for a complication of CLL called Richter's transformation.
Excellent. And we will be sending you all information about any resource that we've given on the call today, so we will give you a reference to this as well. So thank you. Thank you. And we have another phone question coming in.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Peter I. Your line is open.
Hi. My question is, I'm a watch and wait newly diagnosed patient. Should I try to hold on to watching and waiting as long as I can because of all the new things coming down the line? Do I risk burning any bridges by having treatment earlier?
That's an excellent question. Dr. Brown, do you want to address that?
Sure. So, you know, as we've been talking about, we have great treatments now, but we still don't have evidence that if you're on watch and wait and your disease is stable and you feel well, that there's any benefit to treating you early. And many people can stay in that fine watch and wait state for years. And the treatments work very well for a long time, and if you need them, you should start them. We have well-defined sort of criteria for needing treatment. We were talking earlier about symptoms, severe fatigue, severe sweats, weight loss, pain from spleen, for example. Another thing we look at are big lymph nodes, or if the normal blood counts, like the red blood cells or the platelets, are dropping from the CLL. All of those are reasons why we would treat you. And, you know, I have many patients tell me that they're sort of afraid to get treated when they need treatment because they're afraid that it starts some timeline on how long their therapy will work. And I really, really wouldn't worry about that, because we have a huge number of great treatments now, and more are coming down the pike. And if you need treatment, you'll feel much better if you're treated. But if you don't need treatment, then I wouldn't get treated, because side effects do happen, and we don't yet know that doing treatment when you don't need it is helpful.
Thank you. Dr. Pagel, did you want to add anything? Or?
Oh, I couldn't have said it any better. I'm going to let that speak for itself.
Okay. Excellent. Thank you. Thank you both. And our next question, I'm going to give to Dr. Pagel. What are the names of the drugs that are used to get around or prevent the resistance to ibrutinib?
What are the names of the drugs that get around resistance to ibrutinib? Is that the question?
Yes, get around or prevent the resistance to ibrutinib.
Well, unfortunately, I don't, and maybe others know, but I don't know of any that we've proven or specifically shown to this point that are able to help us avoid resistance to ibrutinib. There is research doing this, certainly. In fact, I think even at Dr. Brown's institution as well, of looking at novel drugs that we think might help us overcome resistance to ibrutinib. But that's still very investigational. Heat shock protein drugs are, in particular, the names, and I'm sure Jen could mention those more if it were needed. But we don't know exactly how to prevent resistance. It's something we talk about all the time. And even more specifically, we are trying to figure out how not only do we prevent resistance, but how do we always overcome it and allow us to continue using drugs that we know are very important, like ibrutinib, or the class of drugs that ibrutinib falls into. Jen, I don't know if you had other comments on that as well.
Well, I just want to say that I hope I didn't generate confusion on this point, because I mentioned in the emerging therapies the idea that there would be some new inhibitors against the same target as ibrutinib that might work even in resistant patients. Those are still in the lab. None of them have made it into the clinic yet, but we're hoping that one of them at least will make it into the clinic later this year. And that's specifically to target that mutation. You know, the question of prevention or addressing other pathways, like Dr. Pagel was talking about, remains a very open question, unfortunately, but people are working on it diligently.
Excellent, thank you. And another question, actually wonderful online questions, I have to say. This is a wonderful wonderful participation and engagement by all of our audience. I must say the questions are incredible. Can you explain what complex karyotype is and how to tell on a FISH test if you have it? Dr. Brown?
Sure. So complex karyotype, we were talking... It means that there are multiple genetic changes in the CLL cells, specifically three or more. And so CLL cells, compared to other cancers, actually have relatively few of these changes. But it's recently been found that a subset of CLL has these extra changes. And that has been associated in some cases with potentially shorter responses to certain therapies. Now, you can't necessarily tell this from a FISH test. And the reason for that is because FISH looks just at a few specific spots. And you actually need to do something, a different test, which is called a karyotype or a stimulated karyotype, because that looks across all the chromosomes. This is getting sort of technical. And that test is still, it's not always available everywhere. And we're also not, in most cases, exactly significant. We don't have a lot of data on the significance of having this complex karyotype in many contexts. And so that's still something that's being studied fairly intensively in research, particularly in the context of some of these newer drugs like ibrutinib.
Another question for Dr. Pagel. Is the doubling of the white count over 6 months without other symptoms a sufficient cause for the start of treatment, which I think was in part addressed, but if we could address it again since the question seems to be coming in again.
Yeah, Carolyn, boy, sorry about your voice. So, yes, the question is if your white count or your lymphocyte count in particular is doubling within 6 months or less, is that a reason to get treatment? And the answer is yes. We have defined criteria that support that. But in general, the reason is that even if you're feeling well, if we leave that alone or let that continue, eventually you won't feel well. And what we in general know is that we do better treating knowing that there's a reason to treat again, but do better treating before you're perhaps feeling very poorly, meaning that you're going to maybe tolerate treatment a little bit better. It might be a little bit easier to deliver. So rapidly elevated or rising, I should say, white blood cell count, doubling lymphocyte count in less than 6 months is a reason to get treated because, again, there'll be some symptoms that's going to develop probably not too long down the road.
Thank you. Well, this has been an amazing call. I actually want to thank all of our speakers. It really has been outstanding on this call, just an amazing call. I want to thank all of our participants as well for actually your excellent questions. Really, just a very, I have to say, the sophistication of our participants has been increasing with your wonderful questions. And I also, of course, want to thank all of you who have been listening on the call as well and remind all of you that we may not have gotten to all your questions. So I first of all want to address that. If we did not get to your questions, we often suggest that you contact the National Cancer Institute for any questions you did not have answered that you're still concerned about. And their number is 1-800-422-6237, or you may visit their website at www.cancer.gov. That's a wonderful resource, of course, for all of you to use. And their website does have a live chat feature so that you can post your question, and they can address that for you. In addition, the CLL Society has a wonderful website where you can access a lot of information. And, of course, we don't want to forget your healthcare team. They're, of course, the most wonderful resource because they know the most about you in terms of your treatment and all the specifics of your CLL. So I would definitely encourage all of you to bring your questions to your healthcare team. However, if any of you are feeling that you would like some psychosocial support, someone to talk to about your CLL, some practical financial assistance, to join a support group or telephone or online support group, to access some of our publications or visit our website, then I would definitely suggest, of course, that you go ahead and call Cancer Care at 1-800-813-4673 or visit our website at www.cancercare.org where you can pose a question and one of our oncology social workers will get back to you and really work with you on those questions and also work with you on any issues that you have that might come up. So I want to thank you all for your participation. I do want to remind all of you that we are starting on a series. It's called Life with Cancer. It's a 5-part series, and it actually starts on May 3rd, so you'll all be getting information about that series. But it might be of interest to you because it covers a lot of the different issues that you may all be confronting in your coping with CLL. So I invite you to participate in that if you wish. And again, I want to wish you all a very fine day, and thank you all for your participation.